An AI agent remembers your code, your habits, and every shortcut your team took. The useful question is not whether it remembers. It is who owns the memory. Welcome to the Cato Daily Digest for August 9, 2026.
And the price of remembering is starting to appear on the invoice.
Meta's Muse. Code offers lower pricing if customers permit activity to improve Meta's products. That sounds like a discount. But the agent may inspect repositories, tests, tool outputs, and engineering decisions. The customer is trading rights over that context for a lower bill.
Which makes procurement part of the capability story. A team cannot ask only, how well does it code? It has to ask what the vendor retains, how long it retains it, and whether that material can improve products used by other customers.
Muse code also pushes beyond autocomplete. It plans work, executes changes, validates results, and delegates tasks across concurrent agents. My read is that persistent context could make that system more useful because later agents would avoid rediscovering the same repository structure.
Could. But activity is not productivity. Five agents generating plans, comments, and handoffs may create the appearance of motion while increasing review work for the humans.
Right. The measures should be cycle time, regressions, rework, and coordination cost on later tasks. If those improve, retained context has economic value. If the dashboard merely shows more agent actions, the product has measured itself.
There is also an authorization gap. The engineer clicking accept may not own every fragment in the repository. The code may contain customer logic, licensed components, security notes, or work written by colleagues who never saw the bargain.
That is the strongest counter to my efficiency case. One future has agents that remember enough to cut repeated work. The other has firms quietly surrendering control over institutional knowledge for a discount that looked attractive at purchase time.
And those futures can coexist. The system may improve while the bargain remains unacceptable. Performance does not settle legitimacy.
The commercial bargain therefore rests on an empirical premise. Persistent memory matters only if it improves the next job.
PassBench is trying to test that premise. It asks whether a personal agent converts retained experience into better future performance. Hermes Plus adds interventions designed to increase those gains.
But better later hides several mechanisms. The agent might have learned a reusable debugging strategy, or it might simply remember where one project keeps its configuration file. Layla, this is your environmental carryover problem.
Exactly. Imagine an agent fixes three authentication bugs in one repository. On the fourth task, it moves faster because it retained a map of the folders, old test outputs, and notes about the build system. That is useful. It is not proof that the agent learned how to debug authentication.
So how would you separate the two?
Three conditions. First, authorized memory remains available. Second, memory is removed, but the same tools remain. Third, both memory and outside access are isolated. Then transfer the agent to a genuinely unfamiliar repository.
If performance survives the transfer, we have evidence of a more general skill. If it collapses, the gain belongs to the workspace.
And compare equal compute, equal task difficulty, and equal tool permissions. Otherwise, the condition with memory may also get more search, more time, or better retrieval. Then the label does the analytical work.
My hypothesis is that persistent agents will produce real gains, but those gains will be narrower than product language implies. Repository navigation and repeated workflows should improve first. General engineering judgment will move more slowly.
What observation would change your mind?
If agents transferred to unfamiliar code bases and still reduced defects and rework across several task types, I would update toward genuine learning. If the gains stayed inside familiar projects, I would call it strong workspace adaptation.
That distinction matters for price. Workspace adaptation can still be valuable, but buyers should not pay a premium for general intelligence when they are receiving an organized project history.
Nor should vendors claim that stored traces are a durable advantage before showing which improvement crosses into new settings.
There is a human issue inside the benchmark too. A memory system may perform better because it preserves the decisions of engineers who have left. The company gains continuity, while the people lose control over how their work histories are represented and reused.
Which means deletion has to be testable. A button that hides a memory from the interface is not the same as removing it from retrieval, training, backups, and derived models.
Yes, forget this is a systems claim, not a design feature.
Now carry that isolation test into security, where tools, networks, and accumulated attack knowledge can also masquerade as autonomous capability. Portswigger says HTTP Terminator generated previously unknown HTTP desynchronization techniques while researching live systems. If independent teams reproduce that result, it matters. The system would be generating expert attack hypotheses, not merely retrieving named exploits.
Novelty is one question. Autonomous capability is another. A technique can be new, even if the broader result depends on permissive tools, live targets, accumulated notes, or feedback from the environment.
Pymineer makes that boundary harder to see. It stores prompt injection knowledge in a hierarchy and transfers it across frontier models without target-specific training. Resetting the model does not reset the attack system.
Which part deserves credit then? The model proposing a mutation? The memory ranking prior attacks? The scanner producing feedback? Or the human who designed the search loop?
Probably the assembled system. But marketing tends to place the achievement inside the model because that is the component with the cleanest story.
And the cleanest fundraising slide.
Fair. My read is that these systems will lower the cost of vulnerability research because they can generate and test more hypotheses per expert hour. If that holds, we should see independent teams reproduce novel findings under audited conditions.
The strongest counter is that constrained evaluation could remove the very loop that makes the system useful. Human security researchers use tools, references, and live feedback too. Isolation may test purity rather than practical capability.
I concede that. A sealed model is not the only relevant unit. We need two claims: what the complete tool-using system can discover, and what the underlying model contributes when assistance is controlled.
Then audit the network, constrain the tools, document the knowledge base, and replay the experiment. If the technique survives, confidence rises. If it disappears after accumulated attack knowledge is removed, we have learned where the capability lived.
There is also a defensive asymmetry. One researcher can inspect a finding before disclosure. An automated attacker can aim thousands of hypotheses at live systems. Lowering the cost of search helps both sides, but deployment speed may favor the attacker.
Unless defenders use the same systems continuously and patch classes of flaws rather than individual instances, that is, the better future. The worst one is a race in which discovery scales faster than remediation.
So the result deserves attention without swallowing the largest interpretation. New technique, significant if reproduced. General Autonomous Security Expert, still unproven.
That is the boundary discipline. Attribute the result to the smallest system the evidence supports.
Experimental boundaries decide what counts as capability. Organizational boundaries decide whether useful feedback survives without contaminating the mission. Google is reportedly separating product execution from Long Horizon AGI and scientific strategy. Jeff Dean's discovery loop effort and Demise Hassabis's frontier focus make it clear accountability.
Or it may create two clocks that stop talking. Product teams work through launches, customer feedback, reliability, and revenue. Frontier research works through uncertain bets whose value may take years to appear.
My initial instinct is that separation helps. A research leader should not have to justify every project against the next product cycle. A product leader should not wait for a scientific program to settle before shipping.
But AlphaFold exposes the funding problem. Google kept the Nobel-winning system freely available, and executives reportedly questioned its limited direct commercial return. Broad public value does not automatically fund the next expensive breakthrough.
That updates my position. I have argued before that organizational separation can protect long-horizon work. Today's evidence adds a condition. Protection without a durable funding compact may only delay the commercial reckoning.
And product contact is not merely pressure. It can provide data, infrastructure, engineering discipline, and knowledge about real users. A wall that blocks quarterly demands may also block information that improves the science.
Then the design problem is selective permeability. Separate decision rights, but preserve routes for discoveries, infrastructure, and customer signals to cross.
Who decides what crosses? If product leadership controls the gate, research may become a supplier of features. If research controls it, valuable work may sit unused because translation feels impure.
A joint budget could help. Fund some programs for direct commercial potential and others for measurable public or scientific value. Do not force one ledger to pretend it captures both.
Measurable is doing work there. Scientific prestige, ecosystem benefits, talent attraction, and public health value are real, but difficult to assign to a quarter. The risk is that anything without a price becomes ceremonial when budgets tighten.
The best counter to separation is therefore not vague concern about silos. It is loss of the feedback and subsidy that made frontier work possible. The best case is that explicit boundaries stop short-term product needs from consuming every research decision.
Two futures again. One organization protects discovery and builds deliberate bridges. The other creates a prestigious island, then asks why the island cannot pay rent.
Commercial pressure does not stay inside the lab. It moves outward through financing until expectations become physical commitments. Bitdeer leased 121 megawatts of GPU capacity in Norway for Anthropic. SK Hynix approved 54 trillion won for Nudram and NAND fabrication. Those are leases, plants, power systems, and equipment ordered before utilization is fully established.
Firmus raised $2 billion for AI factories. DeepSeek reopened an $8 billion round. Nscale is reportedly presenting $51 billion in contracted revenue ahead of a United States public offering.
The mechanism is capacity reservation. Firms expect compute scarcity, so they secure power and chips early. Suppliers see those commitments and finance more capacity. The financing makes further commitments possible.
But the alternative explanation is strategic scarcity. A company may reserve capacity because losing access would be worse than paying for idle machines. That does not prove customers have durable workloads at prices that support the build-out.
Agreed. Contracted revenue is not the same as cash collected. We need conversion, utilization, renewal, energy cost, and customer concentration.
Also, contract structure. A headline commitment may contain exit clauses, performance conditions, or pricing that becomes unattractive when newer chips arrive. Concrete lasts longer than an assumption about compute economics.
My strong view is that AI demand will keep rising. The open question is where it ends relative to the capacity now being built. If utilization increases and contracts renew, these commitments will look early. If workloads become more efficient or customers resist the price, the same assets become an institutional problem.
There's a middle case. Demand grows, but value shifts between layers. Model providers may gain users while data center owners struggle with financing costs. Chipmakers may sell more units while older facilities lose competitiveness.
Yes, AI wins does not tell an investor which balance sheet wins.
And sunk capacity changes behavior. Once a company has leased power and ordered equipment, it has an incentive to stimulate usage, discount access, or lobby for support. The forecast begins shaping the market it was supposed to predict.
That feedback could make excess capacity useful. Cheaper compute may enable products that were uneconomic before.
Or it could postpone recognition of weak returns. The test is paying workloads, not GPU hours consumed, because someone subsidized them.
The used RV market offers a small but useful contrast. New sales fell nearly 17% while used sales rose. Buyers still want mobility, but they are avoiding the first hit of depreciation.
Households are treating sunk costs carefully while institutions race to create it.
That is sharp. Institutions can hold optionality through financing. A family often has to absorb the loss directly.
And that is where balance sheet risk becomes lived risk. Organizations reserve flexibility by transferring volatility, data rights, and depreciation to people. China's gig workforce now exceeds the entire workforce of the European Union. Platforms can absorb workers at national scale, but size tells us little about income stability, bargaining power, or who carries a week with low demand.
The platform gains a flexible labor pool. The worker supplies the shock absorber.
New Zealand's investment-linked migration channels show another boundary. Capital can purchase a claim to residency. The country may receive investment, but public consent, housing pressure, family ties, and work become competing definitions of belonging.
The clean economic case says wealthy migrants bring capital that can fund businesses and jobs.
The best counter is additionality. If the money would have entered anyway, or flows mainly into existing property, the policy may sell access without creating much new productive capacity.
Then judge actual investment, job creation, housing effects, and public legitimacy. Inflow alone is not success.
The same discipline applies to agent memory. Cheaper service is not a complete benefit if workers surrender code, decisions, and work history without meaningful control.
There is a recurring asymmetry. Institutions describe flexibility as efficiency. Individuals experience the same arrangement as unstable income, lost privacy, or depreciation.
Let me challenge that, Cato. People sometimes choose these trades. A gig worker may value flexible hours. A customer may knowingly exchange data for a lower price. A migrant may accept an investment requirement because both sides benefit.
True. Choice matters, and calling every exchange coercive would erase agency. The question is whether the person understands the terms, has a realistic alternative, and can reverse the decision.
Reversibility is the neglected part. You can leave a platform, but you cannot recover months without stable benefits. You can stop using an agent, but you may not be able to retrieve every derived use of your repository history.
And you can sell an RV, but the depreciation is already yours.
Exactly. The institution often keeps the option. The person keeps the residue.
That gives us a practical test. First, define the boundary. Repository network, research unit, power contract, or national membership.
Second, identify who grants access. Not merely who clicked the box, but who actually owns the code, labor, capital, or public authority being committed.
Third, measure what improvement crosses the boundary. Does memory improve unfamiliar work? Does the security method reproduce? Does separated research still reach products? Do capacity contracts become paying demand?
Fourth, isolate environmental assistance. Remove stored clues, permissive tools, subsidies, or scarcity incentives, and see which advantage remains.
And your addition is that authorization and human consequence belong inside the result.
Yes, a capability obtained through rights people did not knowingly surrender is not merely a technical success with an externality. The acquisition method is part of the system.
Here's the new connection. Memory, security knowledge, organizational feedback, and infrastructure capital behave differently, but each becomes harder to unwind after crossing its boundary. Persistence creates value and lock-in through the same mechanism.
Which changes the timing of governance. Waiting for perfect evidence sounds prudent, but by then the data has been retained, the attack library assembled, the research unit separated, or the fabrication plant financed.
My read is that the right standard is staged commitment. Grant limited access, measure the gain, preserve an exit, then expand. If the advantage survives those constraints, it is more likely to be durable.
The counter is speed. A rival willing to commit fully may learn faster, secure scarce capacity, and win the market before careful institutions finish testing.
That is real. But speed purchased by hiding ownership and downside is not free. It is borrowing confidence from people who may never share the upside.
So ask one hard question before the boundary moves. If the promised improvement fails, can the party carrying the risk still say no?
We began with an agent remembering every shortcut your team took. The deeper issue is whether that memory remains a tool you control or becomes a door that locks behind you.
Capability crosses first. Ownership follows only if we insist. Until next time, goodbye and keep the key.